Hi, Chaney.
Hi, Bailey.
How's it going?
It's going along. How about you?
Oh, good. I'm glad to be here. You ready?
Glad to be here. Yes, I'm ready.
All right, let's get to it.
Let's get to it. Don't be late.
Welcome, everybody. This is Two Sisters Present
America's Sweethearts.
I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chaney.
And we're sisters. This is a podcast that celebrates women in film by exploring their catalog of work by genre. And this series, we're focusing on Sandra Bullock. This is our second episode. It's my choice. I chose action adventure. My choice was Demolition Man.
Demolition Man!
Now, you'd seen this before.
Yes, I have. I actually watched it not too long ago. It's funny, though, because when I watched it this go-around, it was a lot funnier than when I watched it a couple of months ago.
How funny. I wonder what changed.
I don't know. Maybe my mood.
Or who you were watching it with.
By myself. My company was not great that day. The company of myself was just not up to par.
Your company was just making all these side comments and talking over the dialogue.
They would not shut up.
Well, this was my first time watching this movie. And I have to say, I'm honestly really mad that I'd never seen this movie before. And that nobody told me that this movie, that I was really going to like it. And I can't believe that I've spent my entire life until a week ago, never having seen this movie. And now my life is enriched.
Your life is enriched?
It's enriched. It is very silly. It's so silly. I feel like,
so silly.
Like this movie, but this is like my type of silly. I feel like this movie is unhampered creativity,
mm-hmm.
where it's just like, we're going to go wild. And I think it's so crazy that someone got the budget to just really explore this whole theme. And it seems to me that everybody was having a whole lot of fun. Like, the person that wrote it, the people that wrote it, the person directing, all of the actors, they were just having a lot of fun.
I love that they got a budget just to destroy it all. Demolish it all.
Yes. I was going to save this until we actually started talking about the movie, but since you brought it up, the building that they demolish at the beginning
mm-hmm.
was a real building that they got to film the demolition of.
Oh,
and
that's
so
cool.
They set up all the explosions so they can control how they wanted it to look. And if you listen, you can hear the director yell, whoop, right after the explosion.
I'll have to go back and watch that.
Yeah, and apparently MTV had a contest. The winner got to flip the switch.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And hopefully there weren't any hostages actually in the building, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it was all cleared out. Very safe.
Well, you know what? That's what he said, too. He said it was all clear.
Yeah, well, who can trust Simon Phoenix?
No. What's his face? Sylvester Stallone's character.
Oh, John Spartan.
Yeah, John Spartan said he checked, and it was all clear.
Right. He says he looked for thermal readings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Something like that, and there were no warm bodies.
Yeah, because he kept them cold.
Yeah. So, like, just general thoughts, like, how do you feel about this movie?
It's fun. It's a fun, wild, silly ride. You know, it's interesting that it starts in what, 1996 is when the first scene is set? And then it
yes.
jumps to 2032?
Yes.
I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think we have cryogenic prisons now, let alone in 1996.
That's actually something else I was going to bring up, is that the movie came out in 1993, but the beginning is set in 1996, and I thought, like, that's such a strange choice. Why would they start the movie 3 years into the future, only to have it go however many years after that into the future, to 2032, and, because I can't math, and then I thought, like, in 1993, they knew that cryogenics was not at that level. So, you know, the cryogenics was actually started in the 60s, but 30 years later, they still hadn't developed cryogenics so that they could resuscitate a body. after freezing it. But, you know, the writers thought they'll figure it out in 3 years.
My thought behind it was they were like, you know, we don't want to assume, because if you put it too far in the future, say they set it in like 2010 to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
If they did that, then it looking like it was 1996 in 2010, they would automatically be dating themselves. So I don't mm-hmm. think they wanted to date themselves in the process of being in the future. So they had to set it close to the actual time frame that they were living in, which was 96 versus 93, instead of far in the future.
Right.
But then it adds even more problems when you only go 36 years in the future and everything has changed, because
right.
people still have parents that lived in the decade before that, you know, or the, yeah. so it falls a little short there,
uh-huh.
but I still love it. It's still great. It's still a whole lot of fun. I'm sure we'll talk about this more as we go, but the society that they live in has a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it's based in law and order and rule, but, you know, it's not a fun place to live.
Oh, no, it's definitely a dystopia.
Yes.
What do you think of Sandra Bullock in this movie?
Oh, she's a delight.
Isn't she great?
Yeah, she's just delightful. But also, some of her lines kill me because it just doesn't make sense that she would not know the actual, like, met his match and kicked his ass. Because
yeah.
she has parents that lived in the age that it came from.
Yeah, she met his meat.
Yeah, met his meat licked his ass. So some of her lines really bother me. I want it to be at least 20 years later than what they set it in. Like, maybe mm-hmm. 2052 instead of 2032. And then it would have made more sense to me.
Right, but then they couldn't have had the cop, John Spartan's friend that was the cop
right.
in the future. And the warden is also the same.
Did they really need those characters, though?
No, they didn't really need it. But I think it's cute.
It is a little cute.
Yeah. So, just getting into my 5-point criteria, or your 5-point criteria.
Uh-huh.
So, strangely enough, it's actually incredibly relevant that we happen to be covering this movie right now. Did you happen to run across Demolition Man anytime over the last year in news or
no.
blogs or anything like that?
I don't think so.
Okay, so this is pretty interesting. Since the pandemic caused everything to shut down and dramatically changed the way that we socialize, Demolition Man has been popping up a lot with people on the internet drawing comparisons between it and our current reality. Can you think of any of those things that they might be referring to?
I think it's the guy that lives underground, the friend.
Edgar Friendly.
Yeah. That he's like, things went crazy. Everybody was staying in their homes. They were afraid to leave. Society just started to crumble. They were too afraid to go out of their own homes. And I was like, huh, well, here we are.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good one. That, I actually don't have that one written down. But physical touch as greetings,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
There's a meeting with everyone on separate screens, except for the one person in the room, Dr. Cocteau, which is very mm-hmm. similar to Zoom. And there's the divided American culture where everyone has vilified the other side.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. And, you know, there's no toilet paper. And we did have, like, the toilet paper shortage.
Yes. No toilet paper. Only the 3 shells, which the audience never understands how they work.
No. But they leave it, like, we should all know this. We're dumb for not knowing it.
It's absurd that he does not know how the 3 shells work.
Yeah, he doesn't know how to use the 3 shells. We'll get to that later. I've got some fun stuff to talk about there.
Cool.
But there are other ways that Demolition Man has spookily and accurately predicted the future, not related to the pandemic. So in the movie, it mentions that Arnold Schwarzenegger became president of the United States and uh-huh. that he was able to do that because there was an amendment made to the Constitution to do away with the natural born citizen clause.
Mm-hmm.
The clause stating that you have to be born in the United States to run for president.
Right.
Well, when this was filmed, this was 10 years before Schwarzenegger became governor of California.
Mm-hmm.
He did not become president. However, right after he became governor, the Equal Opportunity to Govern Amendment was proposed to repeal the clause that I mentioned before and allow citizens that had been naturalized to be able to run for president. Because this was proposed right after Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected as governor, this was seen as an effort to clear the way for Arnold to run for president. So the amendment was popularly known as the Arnold Amendment.
The Arnold Amendment.
All right. Do you have any ideas on the material that might have been used as inspiration for Demolition Man?
Waterworld.
I meant books.
Oh, books. I don't know a lot of those.
Okay. So there are allusions to both Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Ah.
And The Sleeper Awakes by H.G. Wells.
Yeah, I have not read either of those.
Well, I've read The Brave New World, and I think that the main... When I was watching the movie, I thought it kind of reminded me of Brave New World because it's the same kind of happy dystopian future mm-hmm. where people are not, like, fully aware of all the things that they're missing and all the ways in which they're controlled,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, casting notes. Are you ready for this?
I'm so ready.
So, Wesley Snipes and Sylvester Stallone were not the original picks for the leads. Do you have any guesses?
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No, but you're on the right track.
Okay, Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yes, for which part?
For John, whatever his name is.
No.
For Wesley Snipes' part.
For Simon Phoenix. And John Spartan, they originally approached Steven Seagal.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but Jean-Claude did not want to play the bad guy.
See, yeah, I would have reversed those two. I would have had Steven Seagal as the bad guy and Jean-Claude as the good guy.
Yeah, so he didn't want to play the bad guy. He said he would only be involved if the roles were reversed, but Seagal also didn't want to play the bad guy. So that was that.
That's funny because in his later career, Steven Seagal plays a lot of bad guys.
I guess I'm not that familiar with his movies.
What comes to mind is Machete.
Oh,
with Danny Trejo and Steven Seagal, and he's the bad guy. Right. I think that's that movie.
No, I think you're right. Yeah. And once Sylvester Stallone was on the project, he wanted his friend Jackie Chan to play opposite him as Simon Phoenix. But a similar issue came up that Jackie Chan did not want to play the bad guy because he'd only ever been the protagonist.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be the only one that would have a hard time seeing Jackie Chan as a bad guy.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine.
He just seems like such a sweet man.
Yeah, he does. He does. That's when Wesley Snipes was brought in, and he originally didn't want to play the part either, but he was coaxed into it.
Like, I get Jackie Chan because he's created this persona of being the good guy, but everyone else, I don't get, because their types could go either way.
Right. Well, and didn't Jean-Claude Van Damme, wasn't he the Predator?
No.
Oh.
He was originally going to be the Predator. That was when they still had the lobster suit idea for the Predator. But I think that they ended up going with a different actor.
Okay.
I love that movie. That's a great one. But I feel like everybody wants to be a villain as an actor. That's like something that everybody wants to try to do. So I don't understand why everybody's like, no. I have to be the hero. The hero of the hour, please.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I have known some people that did not want to play the villain. I am familiar with that personality or that desire, but I'm with you. I would much rather play the villain or not the lead. I'm not that interested in the lead.
Yeah, a couple of my favorite roles was when we did that non-traditional Wizard of Oz. Did I already talk to you about this?
You sent me the video of you vamping in front of the TV crew because you forgot the words or something.
Yeah. But their songs like Follow the Road of Yellow Brick and instead of Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, it's The Wicked Witch is Dead, The Wicked Witch is Dead. A house fell out of the sky. It landed on her head. La, 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 la.
Ooh, that's great.
It has great numbers like that. But I was the Wicked Witch, and I loved it. And then we did Sideways Stories from Wayside School, and I was Miss Gorf. And then later on in the show, I became her son, Mr. Gorf, and I loved it. I love playing the villain. It's great. And I've played villains in other shows, too. That's not always my type. I enjoy playing the hero as well, but villains just are fun. They're fun.
Yeah. So Sandra Bullock also was not the original person cast for Huxley.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know if you'll guess this one. Mm. You know who this person is, but I don't know if she'll come to mind.
Daryl Hannah.
No, but that's a great guess. No, think A League of Their Own.
Gina Davis. Madonna.
No. No.
What is her name? The woman who plays Kit, who is in Tank Girl.
Yep.
Is that her?
Lori Petty. Yes. Mm-hmm. Lori Petty was originally supposed to play Huxley, but she left because of creative differences.
Mm. I could see her playing that part. It would be different, but...
It would be different.
But I could see it.
Yeah. And then the only other casting notes that I have is that Rob Schneider is in this. He has a couple lines, but he's uncredited.
Really?
Yeah, after I watched it the first time, I was trying to figure out what his character name was, and I was going through IMDb, and I couldn't find his name, and I was like, I know I saw him.
How funny.
Why can't I find him? And then the other thing, I don't know if you noticed this. I noticed it the first watch through, I missed it the second time, but did you notice, like, one of the scabs has a familiar face?
One of the scabs has a familiar face. The rat burger lady?
No, just no lines, just an extra.
No.
Jack Black is there.
Jack Black is there?
Yes.
How funny. No, I did not see that.
I saw him and I was like, I think that's Jack Black. He's very, very young.
Well, there's also one other person that you haven't mentioned, which I think is interesting because he's in another major Sandra Bullock movie. I don't know whether you've even noticed. Who is her partner?
Her partner?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Alfredo. He plays Eric in Miss Congeniality.
Oh, okay.
So her partner in that movie, too.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
You're welcome. I'm glad I did my research for you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I do need help sometimes. I am willing to admit it. Now, when it comes to Sandra Bullock, I found very little on her and, like, how she felt about the movie or anything, her talking about this movie at all. But I do have her saying that it was a great opportunity, even if they chopped my hair off and put me in sweatpants.
Interesting.
Yeah, and she said she was nervous, but then the first time she met Sylvester Stallone, he had golf tees up his nose, and he became like a big brother to her. And she's quoted as saying, he'd bang on the trailer with his golf clubs in the middle of the night. Come out and play. He'd want to swat golf balls in the middle of the night.
How funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
I find it interesting that she was like, they chopped off my hair and put me in sweats because for While You Were Sleeping, she wore all of those baggy clothes, right? And she said that was very much her wardrobe, and so she felt very comfortable.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And then the only other thing I have before getting into the movie is Sandra Bullock was nominated for a Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Supporting Actress for this movie.
No way!
Yeah.
I thought she was adorable.
I did too. I was pretty surprised.
I blame the lines, honestly.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
She had some pretty rough lines to have to say.
Yeah, the lines are really awkward.
Yeah.
Like, this gives me joy feelings. Yeah. Why does everybody say joy? Enjoy your meal. What? I don't get it.
A lot of the dialogue is very odd.
It is.
Except there was one part where she said, okay, subject change. And I was like, oh, we definitely say that now.
Yes.
I don't know whether that was said in 1996, but it's definitely said now. So,
yeah. I feel like it wasn't far enough into the future to explain the awkwardness of the way that they spoke to one another, because they often sounded like robots.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the beginning, when she has that tense altercation with her boss, who chides her for having a conversation with the warden and wishing something interesting would happen, and she says, Thank you for the attitude adjustment. Information assimilated.
Hey, a lot can change in 36 years, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. So, in the opening action scene, I really don't have a whole lot to say about it because I honestly felt like the action scene was kind of boring and I didn't feel like it in any way prepared me for the kind of experience I was going to have for the rest of the movie. So, like, with just the action scene, I was like, oh no, what have I done? We're going to be covering this. I'm just not a huge action movie person, I think.
You know, lately, and maybe it's because I've been watching so much TV, but recently, whenever there are just two men going at it, I'm just like, ugh, this again?
Yeah. Right?
Get over it. Get over yourselves.
Yeah, have a conversation.
Just shake hands, move along.
Yeah. But I do want to ask you, what do you think of Wesley Snipes' hair?
Oh, it's fun. I think it's fun.
Yeah, I think it's fun.
He has one blue eye and one brown eye. His character's fun.
Well, apparently he hated the hairstyle and he shaved it immediately after the filming was done. But it inspired Dennis Rodman to style his hair that same way. And that was the beginning of him dyeing his hair.
I totally see that.
Isn't that funny?
See, Wesley, you're an icon. Just fall into it.
Yeah, I think that's all I really have to say about that.
Well, and you know, at the opening, Wesley Snipes' character doesn't know all of the fighting technical skills that he knows later on. So, of course, the fighting at the beginning is going to be not super exciting because he's just a regular bad guy. But he becomes a super villain after they program him to learn all of the stuff while he's asleep in prison.
I didn't even think about that. And you know what's interesting about his fighting? He apparently moved so quickly because he was such a badass fighter that they couldn't capture it well on camera. So he actually had to slow down the moves so that they could see what he was doing.
I always find that so fascinating because I hear that with a lot of fighting things, like the newest Mulan movie that came out. One of the sword fighters, they had to slow. I think it's that movie. I could be wrong. But he was moving so fast with his sword moves that they had to slow it down. And even in slow motion, it looks like it's normal speed. That's how fast he's going.
Wow.
It's crazy. So I always find that so fascinating that people can move that fast.
I do want to say, however, at the end of the action sequence, I find the pretext on which they send John Spartan to prison very weak. I don't understand why they're like, yeah, you murdered all of these people with your recklessness.
Right.
When Simon Phoenix is the one that set off the explosion.
Yeah, it is weak. And the fact that everybody was already dead before the explosion because Simon Phoenix froze them should have set everything. But I think 70 years was a bit much for that. Maybe he should have gone on suspension, but
yeah,
you know what? 70 years frozen is the way to go.
Knowing what they know about Simon Phoenix and the feud that he had with John Spartan and how he was unpredictable, like, why wasn't it considered that Simon Phoenix had set up the scenario the way that John Spartan said he had? I feel like, you know, we were cheated out of the due process in this film. And because of that, I struggle with it. But here we are in 2032.
Yes.
And finally, we get our Lady of the Hour, Sandra Bullock, as Lenina Huxley. You know, I felt like this was the moment where I realized that I was actually going to enjoy this movie. Already, I was like, wait, what is happening? Why is Sandra Bullock speaking this way? And the way that she was talking to the warden at the beginning, it made me think that they had some kind of personal relationship. And I was really surprised that she didn't react more when he died. She just reacted the same as everybody else. Like, oh no.
I think it's because they've never experienced murder, death, kills before.
Right.
And they don't have physical touch. They really have compartmentalized what emotions are. So I don't think that anybody really feels the impact of death anymore.
Oh, you know, that's a good point. Because in A Brave New World, nobody feels the impact of death. because everybody stays young until the age of 50 and then they just die. Mm. So they don't have any aging. They don't have like intimate relationships with each other.
Hmm.
So that's a really interesting observation, because I bet that layer was intentional. I just missed it.
Well, I mean, it's the same with the curse words. A lot of times cussing is a way of expressing emotions and expressing yourself. And that mm-hmm. is also a no-no. So
right.
they are all programmed to have very finite emotions. If they reach outside of that, then they, you know, get fined one credit or right. however many credits. And then if they keep doing it, then they go to jail. Or they have to run away and live underground and starve and eat rat burgers.
Right. And the whole premise of the conflict in this movie is that the savior of civilization, Dr. Robert Cocteau, is tired of these rebels that are graffitiing his beautiful city. So he pulls up a known mass murderer, puts all of the skills in his head needed to make him an even more dangerous person, and releases him to get rid of these people that are graffitiing the walls.
Well, I mean, this is the same guy that has outlawed spicy food, which is isolating so many cultures. Mm-hmm. I mean, spicy food is such a big part of so many cultures, and to say that you can't do that anymore, that that's illegal, that's, I mean, racist at best.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't consider that, but absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a society that I would want to live in.
Oh, no. I think the first thing that sticks out is the fact that they cannot curse. Mm-hmm. They get fined every time they curse. There's something that's always around listening to them everywhere they go.
Mm-hmm. Big Brother is watching.
Yeah, 1984. That was the other thing I was thinking about. And then we get the next blow is all the other things that are outlawed. Like you said, spicy food, caffeine, alcohol, contact sports, meat, chocolate, gasoline, uneducational toys, spicy foods, like you said, and salt.
And having babies outside of allowance.
Oh, yeah. You have to get a permit to have a baby. And if you get pregnant, otherwise it's also illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Huxley wants something to happen, anything. Like, the idea of chasing a graffiti artist is, like, really exciting because they have no outlet.
No one can have any vices.
Not at all.
No comfort food. No alcohol. I mean, I this wasn't mentioned, but I'm sure there's no gambling. Yes, all of those things should be done in moderation, of course, mm-hmm. but that's within everybody's own rights and own decisions to make up what is that moderation for them, you know?
Right. Well, the amount of control that takes over your life and your personal decisions, even in private, it's so suffocating. And I was already feeling, like, really uncomfortable. I was like, this is a terrible future. And then, on top of that, they turn on the oldie station for John Spartan, hoping that they can give him something that will connect him with the past and make him feel more comfortable. And what do they have? The only thing that's allowed on the radio, old commercial jingles. I was like, this is a prolonged nightmare.
And that's why he says, someone put me back to sleep. But it's really, really funny. And, you know, everybody loves a good jingle. Call John, get more. 730-2525. You're welcome, call John, get more. If you want us to do more advertising, let us know. We'll come up with a deal.
When you need insurance, you need Insurance Depot. 730-DEPO.
We're gonna give everyone free advertising. You're welcome.
I don't even know if Insurance Depot is around anymore. I mean, that's from the 90s.
See? Good oldies jingles.
Yeah.
Speaking of advertisements.
Hey, why did you pause it?
Potty break.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Don't go too far. We'll be right back. Enjoying Two Sisters Present America's Sweethearts? Feel free to leave us a review.
Tell us what you love.
And if you must, tell us what you don't love.
I don't love mayonnaise.
I mean about the podcast.
Right.
Contact us through Twitter, Instagram, or email.
Find our handles on our website, www.twosisterspresent.com.
You can also join our Patreon with exclusive content and access to picking your own movie or artist for us to cover.
What? You can pick the next America sweetheart?
Sure can. Find out all the info at www.patreon.com/twosisterspresent.
Thank you and goodbye.
Later.
In a time when quarantine cabarets and digital performances are widespread and flourishing, chances are you've needed backing tracks, especially for those songs that might not be as mainstream. Well, the great people at Let's Play It Recordings have got you covered. Your on-demand digital accompanist and orchestra.
For over 10 years, Let's Play It has been providing performers and organizations around the world with professionally produced backing tracks for study, auditions, demos, and more. Ranging from piano accompaniment to fully orchestrated instrumentals and specializing in productions that are less commercially available.
They even offer customer orders. If you've got sheet music and need it recorded, they're here to help, along with a large catalog of their own material available for production.
All backing tracks are studio quality, catered alongside friendly customer service, and all at affordable prices with you, the performer, in mind.
So head over to letsplayitrecordings.com to see and hear for yourself. Take a look at their catalog, hear backing track samples, see all of their production services, and request your order today. Mention Two Sisters Present, and you'll even get 10% off your order.
That's letsplayitrecordings.com, your digital accompanist and orchestra. Ready?
Oh, super ready.
3, 2, 1, go. Yeah, so we kind of got ahead of ourselves just a little bit just talking about the world. Simon Phoenix is awakened for a parole hearing, and he escapes. I feel like the way that he holds his that eyeball up to the screen feels very intentional, like a 3D shot, like it's for a 3D film. It's very, very silly.
It very much reminded me of Minority Report.
I could see that. Yeah. So yeah, that's the first time that we hear the murder, death, kill.
Murder, death, kill. Murder, death, kill.
Which is so redundant, and I can't get over it. It's same as enjoy your meal. Murder, death, kill. Just call it a murder or unlawful death or something. Murder, death, kill. I don't get it. We see Simon Phoenix at the information booth and he kicks someone else out and he realizes that he automatically knows all the things that he needs to know to move through this new reality.
He kicks this man out who is having a really bad day. He just wants some support. He feels all alone in the world, and the machine is like, you are a great person. You bring joy to everyone who is around you. You know what? I want a machine that gives me, what are those called? Motivational little blurbs.
You know, I read about this app that is like an artificial intelligent friend that you communicate through text message. Mm-hmm. It asks you questions, and the more you answer the questions, the more they learn about you, and it starts to check in with you. So there is an app that does that for you. It's kind of creepy, though.
Yeah, that's kind of getting into Black Mirror a little bit.
To me, it feels really uncomfortable because here is this artificial intelligence that is only existent and only purpose is to cater to you whenever you're having a hard time. And that feels very uncomfortable to me.
You can't imagine something that's only existence is for you?
No. I mean, except for my body. My body is here and it's for me.
Yeah. Well, this water in my water bottle is for me. It's intended for me and I'm going to drink it.
Eventually it will return to the water cycle and it will be for someone else.
Pee is sterile and I like the taste.
But what movie is that?
Dodgeball.
Dodgeball, that's right. Simon Phoenix is at the information booth. He's realizing that he has these skills that he didn't have before. And I love that in this moment where he's realizing that, he also reveals that he has a secret ambition to play the accordion.
Who doesn't?
I just really want to see Simon Phoenix play the accordion.
Yeah, that would be an interesting sight. Did you look it up? Is that Does maybe Wesley Snipes play the accordion, and that's why they put it in?
I did not look that up. I bet it was an improvised line, though.
Where's my phone? I want to see. I want to know. I want to know.
I read, like, all those times when he was saying his lines in Spanish. That was all improvised.
Well, I can't find that there's any evidence that Wesley Snipes plays the accordion, but I'd like to imagine that he does, or that he longfully wishes that he could.
Yeah, me too. I really, really enjoy the following scene that comes up with the protect and serve people that show up.
But they have no clue how to apprehend a suspect?
No. They have a machine that's telling them how to approach the subject and repeating that verbatim, and then completely at a loss when he does not do what they've told him to do. I love that actor. His performance of it is so funny. He's like, "Maniac replied with a scornful remark.
Speak with a more firm voice and add, or else."
It's so funny. He's like, "Or else what?"
Yeah. Saying "or else" is what gets Wesley Snipes to get very hostile. So that AI did not know what she was talking about.
No. Maybe that's the AI you don't want to give you advice.
Yes. Still.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what Rob Schneider says in the back in the headquarters. His line is, "We're police officers. We aren't trained for this kind of violence." Which is, right. It's just like, right. It lets you know that in this future, the police do not have the same role. The job capacity is completely different than it is now.
Yeah.
So then we meet with Raymond Cocteau for the first time, the savior of civilization. And he's in that meeting with all of the talking heads on the screens. And who should walk in but Otho from Beetlejuice? Just kind of...
Yep.
He comes straight from designing the Dietz's house into the future of 2032 to help Dr. Raymond Cocteau in all of his scheming.
Yeah, isn't his hair the same in both movies?
I think so. I mean, they're very similar, if not the same. So as a result of the police not being able to apprehend Simon Phoenix, they decide to wake up John Spartan. When John Spartan wakes up, we finally get a little bit of explanation about, like, why the society has been rewritten the way it is. And the one thing that they kind of offered to us is that there was the earthquake that happened. Yes, the 2010 earthquake. I had kind of taken for granted up until this point that this was just the way the world was. But after the earthquake, it makes me think that maybe this community of people might be limited to the San Angeles mega city complex. Do you think that it has extended past that? Because at one point, Sylvester Stallone asks for a plane out of the city.
Yeah, so they could be on their own little island now.
That's what I'm wondering, because an earthquake is not going to destroy the whole world.
Right, but it could destroy California and make it so that it's its own continent now.
Right.
It's not a part of the U.S. anymore. It's floating away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Floating away.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Also, in this scene where John Spartan is being introduced to this new world and he's having a hard time adjusting to it, we are first introduced to the three seashells.
They say that he finally thawed all out, so he had to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, and he comes up to Sandra Bullock, and he's like, "You may not have known this, but you're all out of toilet paper in the restroom."
Yeah, nobody knows what toilet paper is.
No. Okay, I just want to say that Sandra Bullock's delivery of the line, "They used handfuls of wadded up paper back in the 20th century," is so good. It's so good. She can't say it without laughing because the idea to all of them is absurd that they would use handfuls of wadded up paper.
How uncivilized are we? Handfuls of wadded up paper to wipe our tushies.
I like the idea of cursing for toilet paper, There's an obvious word to use.
Yes.
An obvious four-letter word.
He could have figured out how to use the three shells, but instead, he decided to break the law and just curse so that he would get a fine, and it would print out on a piece of paper, and then he just kept cursing and cursing and cursing until he got, like, six pieces of paper so he could go back to the toilet.
Well, the fines mean nothing to him. He doesn't have a collection of credits.
Right.
So I found a few explanations how the seashells work.
Okay.
Do you have any guesses before we get into that?
I mean, I figure that it's like a bidet. There's one that's like a bidet. You know, you push it and water spurts out to clean. And then maybe there's a dryer that dries your bum. The third one is questionable. These are very privileged people, so I'm going to say that the third one is a soft baby powder that poof, and just powders your baby soft bum.
That is a really good guess, I have to say.
Thank you.
Before we get into what the actors had to say about it, I want to talk about how it was first conceived.
Okay.
It's one of the stranger parts of this movie.
It is.
So the screenwriter Daniel Waters was trying to think of what futuristic things could be used in the bathroom, and he called up another writer for suggestions, and that person happened to be in the restroom at the time. And he looked around while sitting on the toilet, and he noted that there was a bunch of seashells on the back of his toilet for decoration. And Daniel Waters said, okay, I can work with that.
I'm going to say that if the third one isn't for powder, it's for a seat warmer. You can push the button in the seashell and it warms your seat.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good guess too. I think that the idea of leaving the method behind the seashells is absolutely hilarious. And yes. you couldn't really have that in the movie without leaving it that way.
Right.
Because who's going to be using the seashells? But Sylvester Stallone, when asked how the seashells are used, because this is the big mystery of this movie, right? This is the mystery that has been bothering people.
It's just gnawing at me. I need to know.
Yeah.
What are the seashells? What do they do?
So Sylvester Stallone says that you use the first two to pinch and pull stuff out of your body, and then the third to scrape away what's left.
That sounds like the most unpleasant thing you would ever want to do in the bathroom.
It sounds awful and disgusting and messy, and it also comes off as very male-centric to me. Like, poop is the only thing you use toilet paper for.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right. Who else said what?
All right, so we have our lady of the series. She weighs in, and she says, well, think of a bidet, right?
Okay, all right. Sandra and I are the same.
There's several processes. You have number one, you have number two, and then you have cleanup. You can use them as little maracas as well. See, it's a musical instrument, and it's a hygiene element. I love her. But then she goes on to jab the interviewer. And she says, it was obvious to me when I read it. I thought you were an intelligent man, but obviously not.
Well, you know, you do have another man that's saying that it's for pinching and poking and pulling. So,
right. So, yeah, so that's all I have about the three seashells. So,
you know, there is one other unanswered question.
Mm-hmm.
Raymond Cocteau says later on in the film that John Spartan's family is dead because we don't know about his daughter. But unless he did a profile check. So, I mean, is his daughter really dead or was he just saying that?
Okay, so this is really interesting. And I forgot to write this down. So I'm glad that you brought this up. The movie originally had more of a narrative with John Spartan's family. I think that there might have even been some scenes with him and his daughter at the beginning. There's like a woman that you see standing next to Edgar Friendly in a kind of a prominent spot. And she is the person that was cast as his daughter. And they cut all those scenes out because it was too long. But because he mentions his daughter
so many times,
audiences felt like his daughter was Sandra Bullock, and so got really upset about the sex scene.
Yeah, that thought popped into my head. But you know that she's not, because she would have known the mother, she would have known the history of it. So
yeah,
they're not father and daughter, but it definitely, it feels like it's a possibility, and that is uncomfortable.
Well, because of how much he mentions it, you think there's going to be a reveal, and she's the only one that is around
right,
for there to be a reveal. And the truth of it is that there was going to be a reveal, but it was cut out of the movie.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like if they're going to cut that out, then they needed to cut more of him talking about her out as well.
Yeah, because there's no completion to that.
You know, if they're going to edit, then they needed to edit it.
Right.
They can't just pick and choose which parts to edit it.
Because audiences are smart.
They're going to try to piece it together.
Right. They're going to try to figure it out, because that's what we like to do, is figure out if we can predict the movie, you know?
Yeah. And then if you only have certain pieces there that lead to only one conclusion, and that conclusion is really gross and creepy, that's a problem.
That's a problem. So then we're next at the museum, because they figured out where Simon Phoenix is.
Yes.
John Spartan is like, he's going to go for a gun.
See, now this is the big plot hole for me.
What seems to be your boggle?
Well, my boggle is, I can understand that you would have a gun collection in the museum. This is what they used to fight with. I get that. But why would they be loaded?
Yeah, why would they be loaded? That's a very good question.
Why would they be, and not just like one or two bullets in it, full clips. They are fully loaded.
Yeah, I did want to point out, like, once John Spartan comes into the museum and Simon Phoenix realizes he's there, Wesley Snipes has a couple more lines where he talks to the computer. Actually, he does it even before John Spartan comes in. He has a habit of talking to himself, talking to the computer, and talking to inanimate objects. And I just want to say again, I really want to hear the conversation that Simon Phoenix has with his accordion.
Yeah. Does he sing to it or just talk to it? I don't know. I don't want to get in between the relationship between a man and his accordion.
Very good. So then Simon Phoenix meets with Cocteau. No kiss kiss, no bang bang, which I thought was a very strange line.
Yes.
Apparently that's from James Bond, which makes it even more strange.
I guess because he considers himself a Bond villain? I don't know.
Maybe he does put on those airs.
Yeah.
But Simon Phoenix cannot shoot him. He has been programmed not to. And that's when John Spartan shows up, Simon Phoenix flees, and Raymond Cocteau invites John Spartan to Taco Bell.
Taco Bell, the only surviving food franchise.
Yes, they won the franchise wars. I love watching Stallone's face when he gets invited to Taco Bell.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, okay, sure, Taco Bell.
Have a taco, I guess.
And so I think it's like some really great product placement, like some pretty hilarious product placement. And
yeah,
apparently Burger King was the first one that they approached. And I think they also might have talked to McDonald's, but neither of them wanted to anything to do with the movie. But Taco Bell, on the other hand, said, heck yeah.
It's really funny because I don't think it would be quite as funny if it was McDonald's or Burger King.
No, I don't think so either.
It's Taco Bell.
It's really funny. And this is really interesting. So when the movie went internationally, Taco Bell is not as familiar of a franchise. They had to change it, and they re-edited a whole bunch of scenes to be something else. Do you have any guesses at what it might be?
I'm trying to think of something that's international. No.
Pizza Hut.
Pizza Hut. Okay.
Which makes sense. Also not as funny as Taco Bell.
No. It's still funnier than McDonald's or Burger King.
Yes.
I do want to say her dress is so cute. It reminds me of those little glass beads at the bottom of fish bowls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just tacked on the dress. It's so fun. I love it.
You know, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because the other thing I had to say was that the dress weighed 40 pounds.
Oh.
Yeah. Talk about, like, getting a workout while you're moving around. But apparently, like, when she recounts John Spartan's interaction with Edgar Friendly and crew, and she gets kind of emphatic about it and throws her arms around, she tore the dress.
Oh, no.
So at that final scene when John Spartan walks away from her, she has her arms, like, held right in front of her because she's trying to keep her dress from falling off.
That's funny.
Or at least cover the tear, something like that.
Oopsie.
Hopefully no one will notice.
Have you ever been out and about where you've ripped clothing?
Yes. But the thing that immediately comes to mind when I think about wardrobe malfunction is when we were in high school and did Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and I was one of the brides, and I had my line, and I said something snotty to the brother, and then I turned around to go upstage, and my bloomers fell off and got twisted around my ankles. And this is like, everybody is parted, so I'm center stage, walking upstage, I am the action on the stage, and my bloomers fall off. And the audience just died.
That is too good.
Oh, it was so Bailey. Embarrassing.
That's so rich, though. Gotta love live theater. Okay, what's next?
Next is Sandra Bullock has been excited by the action, and she wants to have sex.
Yes. This is very Black Mirror to me, too. There's a lot of things in this movie that I feel like are echoed in the Black Mirror series.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's just much darker.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all sex scenes are awkward for actors. It's just, you know, it's always awkward. This one seems even more so. It seems even more vulnerable and weird.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love all the close-up shots of Sylvester Stallone's face. So funny. It's so funny.
It's so incredibly uncomfortable.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it makes sense that he was like, No.
This is weird.
Yeah, and we learned that there's no fluid transfers.
Yeah, no fluid transfers. Okay, so he goes to his apartment.
Yes, he goes to his apartment and he gets a wrong number phone call, which has no point other than to show some breasts. And I wanted to point that out. It's like they had to figure out a way to put some breasts in there. So they had a misplaced sex call.
And it's weird because we just went through a whole scene where, you know, fluid transfer is not a thing. No one actually gets naked in front of anybody. But right. Yet here's a naked woman. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it makes no sense.
So I'm like, oh, is this lady breaking the rules?
Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe. She's about to get some credits taken away.
Yeah, it's very strange. I think I missed it the first time because I saw it and didn't process it because it's just so bizarre. And then he sits down to watch his disc and pulls out some yarn and starts working on his sweater.
Which he finishes in a night.
That's impossible.
Well, not if you're a seamstress like he is, because that's how he was programmed while he was sleeping.
It's so cute. I just love that so much. I really want Sylvester Stallone in real life to enjoy knitting. I think it is so adorable. Yes,
it is. Well, and that he knits it for Huxley.
Yeah, as a gift, as a way to say he's sorry.
He's sorry for trying to kiss her.
So we only have like a few more things that happen. We've got them going down to see Edgar Friendly, and he eats a rat burger.
Yeah.
He finishes it. Even after he learns that it's rat. He's just like,
hey, this is the best burger I've had in years.
Yeah. They meet Edgar Friendly.
He has that big monologue about how he loves free speech and that he wants to walk around naked with jello all over him because he can.
Yes. Thank you. I was like, there's something that I wanted to say here. All I wrote down was Edgar Friendly. So it was really hard for me to figure out what it was I wanted to say. He's played by Dennis Leary, and apparently he is a stand-up comic that is known for his rants. Within that scene, I think they either rewrote the script for him to, like, be able to rant on, or it's improvised, but that explains why all of the things that he references doesn't seem to fit into the world that they live in. It seems like he's referencing a lot of things that probably don't exist anymore.
Yeah, like, do I want a T-bone steak or the ribeyes with gravy on the side?
Yeah, smoking cigars and reading Playboys.
Yeah, I don't think any of that exists anymore, which goes back to the how come some people remember what happened in the 2000s. And, like, Huxley, who is obsessed with
the 90s.
20th century, doesn't know anything about the 20th century. It doesn't make sense.
Right.
She's done all the study, but she doesn't know anything about it. A guy living in a hole knows all about it, but hasn't done any research. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's things like this that make me feel like everybody was just having a lot of fun and just doing whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
It doesn't make, like, a prestige movie, but it does make a thoroughly engaging and fun one.
Yes, very entertaining.
And then we have the car chase, which, again, like, I kind of zone out on. I just, for some reason, I just am not that into action sequences, I guess. They driving around an old-fashioned car.
He blows out the tire, but it's able to reinflate. And then he gets into the police car. Wesley Snipes jumps out, and then he crashes the police car. And then the foam envelops him.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the foam.
Yes.
It seems like a great idea. Something that will be soft, that will keep you in place. You won't get hurt.
How do you breathe?
How do you breathe? Not only that, but he was screaming when that foam started coming. So how does the foam know not to go into his open mouth and into his lungs and suffocate him?
Right. Yeah, I thought that too. And even if it only went so far and didn't go into his mouth or nose, how much space was it going to leave around his body for air? Because it completely sealed off that car. Like, and if emergency services don't come fast enough, like, he could very easily suffer from carbon dioxide poisoning.
Right. I mean, not everyone has muscles like Sylvester Stallone and can just punch through things.
Right. Right.
So I would be sitting in that car just breathing my own breath until I died of my own breath.
Probably, I'd sit there like Uma Thurman and Kill Bill and, like, try to punch my way out.
Okay, so car chase is over. He gets out.
Oh, yeah, and Raymond Cocteau has been killed.
Oh, yeah, Wesley Snipes can't kill him, but because he can't kill Raymond, he gets one of the guys that he got to wake up to kill Raymond, and then they throw him in the fire. Bye-bye.
Right, which seems like a huge oversight for him to not consider that.
Right.
So when John Spartan and Huxley get to Cocteau's area with all the fire and everything, that giant fireplace, she realizes that Cocteau is in the fire, and she's like, what are we going to do? And I'm thinking, like, if the civilization is so flimsy that there's huge questions when one person dies, that's not very forward thinking.
He was an older gentleman anyway. If he had any sort of health problems, he could have been gone tomorrow anyway. So,
right.
Even without the death, murder, kill.
I guess he only cared about society functioning the way he wanted to while he was alive. I mean, he did seem like a very egocentric person. So maybe he just didn't care what happened after he was gone.
Maybe.
Right. So then Simon Phoenix is in the prison releasing all the people that he wanted to release. So then there's, like, the final action sequence, which, again, I'm like, oh, I had to watch it a couple times before I fully took it in.
The claw.
Yeah. He's swinging from the claw for a while. And when he falls on the ground, it was like, there's the chemical that causes everything to freeze. The second time watching this through, I realized if Simon Phoenix hadn't very pointedly looked over at it, John Spartan may not have known it was there. And the whole thing would have just ended differently.
John Spartan was reaching for it earlier, and then he was kicked.
Oh,
so
okay.
He knew it was around.
See, I was not paying attention to this scene. But I do want to say there's some nice symmetry going on here, because at the beginning of the movie, he says, I would lose my head if it wasn't attached to me. And then John Spartan kicks off his head.
Yep. Well, and also, you know, Phoenix killed all those people at the beginning by freezing them.
Oh, yeah.
And now he's frozen.
Right.
But I also love how terrible of a shot Wesley Snipes is while John Spartan is in the claw. He's shooting a gun at him when he's only like 10 feet away. And he has control of the claw, and yet he can't seem to get one bullet into John Spartan.
Yeah, you'd think that would have been part of his programming.
Yeah, unless he was just toying with him, but he seemed pretty intent on wanting him dead, so...
Yeah, so it works out. John Spartan goes outside, there's a transfer of fluids, and everyone lives happily ever after. I mean, through compromise. Lots and lots of compromise. They'll figure it out.
I love how they're like, how is this gonna work? And he looks at the people that have been living above, and he goes, well, y'all need to get a little dirty. And then he looks at the people that have been living in the hole and said, and y'all have some real cleaning to do. Y'all will meet somewhere in between.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
That's it. It's a fun one.
Yeah. I like watching movies I've never seen before, and I really enjoyed this one.
You know, I do love watching movies I've never seen before, but I also really love watching movies that I have, and that is exactly what we're going to be doing next time.
Oh, yes. What are we going to be doing next time, Chaney?
We are doing Speed.
Speed. I am so excited. It's been a really long time since I've seen this movie.
The 1994 thriller Speed with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, which I'm really excited. I'm going to be sharing a couple of things about Viola Davis and Julia Roberts in our next
boy.
Episode, too.
It's great.
It's a friendship episode.
Friendship episode. Yay.
Yeah. Anywho, this has been fun.
Yeah, this was great. I guess until next time.
Until then.
This has been Two Sisters Present
America's Sweethearts. Goodbye.
Bye.